Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby, and today we're joined by Brent Orsuga. Brent is the founder of Pinnacle Growth Advisors, a headhunting and talent advisory firm solely dedicated to the supply chain and logistics industry. Brent comes from 22 years of recruiting and 15 solely in the logistics space. Brent helps companies from startups to billion-dollar companies find the best possible people. Pinnacle Growth Advisors has won numerous awards in the past 10 years, including the Inc. 5000 Fastest Growing Companies in America. Brent, welcome. Thanks for being here.
I appreciate the ask, and I'm really excited to join you today.
All right, awesome. Hey, I'm curious. I posted on LinkedIn recently my interview with Jeremy Jensen, and I noticed you commented on that. Do you know Jeremy?
I do. So we're both part of the Entrepreneurs Organization, and that's how I first got to know him. But he's also become somewhat of a friend slash mentor. So I've actually gone to him over the years for some what I'm going to call advice or experience shares on how to handle some situations. So he's been a great person in that regard.
Oh, amazing. That's cool. I didn't even realize that until you commented on LinkedIn. So that's good to know. Yeah, the interesting thing with Jeremy was he's grown his search firm to $12 million per year. And he told me one of the keys was having effective lead gen systems in place. And coincidentally, the way that you and I connected was I have a cold email campaign. We're scaling our cold outreach using AI to personalize the messages. And then something I said in that email sparked a conversation between us. And here we are recording a podcast together.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, look, it's recruiting, right? It's a high contact sport and you got to get in front of people and you never know what happens on the other end. So here we are.
So Brent, how did you get into recruiting 22 years ago?
Well, it's actually a pretty funny story because I was actually a candidate. So at the time, after I'm originally from the Bay Area, came out here to go to ASU, played college basketball. And one of the big companies that hires in that world is Enterprise Rent-A-Car. So I actually started my career at Enterprise, not knowing that I was going to be wearing a suit to wash cars in 100 degrees out here in Arizona, but it happened. And oddly enough, there was a very big MRI office here in Scottsdale, and they had contacted me actually as a candidate. And little did I know that they had a motto when you would go in there. It's called keep the best, place the rest. And so as soon as I got in there, they didn't tell me this till afterwards, but they're like, oh, we like this guy. There's something about him. We actually think he can be a really good recruiter. So they actually talked me into becoming a recruiter. Now, what I didn't realize, and I think this is a funny story, is the more I look back on it, recruiting has always been part of my life. It's kind of in the blood, if you will. I can look at it in this regard. I was recruiting kids to come and play sports on my street. I was recruiting people to trade baseball cards, right, on kind of my terms. In college, I was recruiting people on where we would go on the weekend. So recruiting pickup games in basketball. So it's always kind of been inside of me. And then even at a young age, I was hiring, I was interviewing, you know, even at 23, 24 at Enterprise. So honestly, it kind of became second nature. And I started with them in the construction industry, which I knew nothing about.
Wow. Yeah, absolutely. Those early signs were there with trying to influence other people and bring them along with you. So Enterprise Rent-A-Car have quite a well-known and respected graduate training program. Is that how you got involved there? Or
it was, and I'll be honest, it was a great experience because their management training program is one of the best, and it really taught me about leadership and leading other people and kind of understanding that dynamic at a very young age. So it was kind of funny. You know, you start with a bunch of buddies or people that become your buddies. And then within 6 to 8 months, I'm now managing a small office. So I had a really good journey there because I kept elevating at a very, again, young age. And those transferable skills still carry with me to this day.
For sure. Absolutely. So I know, Brent, you and I talked previously and you explained we both agreed on the importance of mindset, and you explained that you make this distinction between a talent advisor versus a recruiter approach. Could you say a little about that?
Yeah, look, I think recruiting sometimes has a negative annotation to it. Like when I think of recruiter, I think of somebody who's sitting in a seat, going through jobs, posting jobs, trying to fill something, especially a lot of you're going to see that in-house, but you're also going to see it on the agency side. See, when I started Pinnacle, and even to this day, the approach that I've always taken is more of like a sports agent. right? So I want to represent all the teams that are out there. I want to make sure that I have relationships with all the biggest players in my industry so that when I'm speaking to somebody, it really allows me to play strategic matchmaking. Because one of the biggest pet peeves that I have in recruiting is I feel like a lot of people are selling or pitching without knowing enough about the person or the company, right? How many people have gotten on a call with a recruiter and they're like, oh, Mark, you're perfect for this role. Well, I don't know anything about you to even know that. So it's an assumption. And or when I do get you on the phone, I'm going to tell you about this amazing opportunity at this amazing company. But guess what? Have I ever been there? Have I been inside the walls? Do I really know the leadership? Have I had success stories there? So you have a lot of people telling you how great a restaurant is you've never eaten at. When I take that talent advising role, you got to understand, I am dialed in with these companies. I know them. I've had success stories there. So it allows me to come from a completely different lens and angle so that when I'm putting you in front of a company, it's not random. It's strategic.
I love that. I've never heard that analogy before. It's a good one. Recommending a restaurant you've never eaten at before. That rings true.
Well, and stay there for a second, Mark, because think about the difference. If I know a restaurant inside and out, I know the waiters, I know the secret items on the menu, I know the best seat to go sit at. I'm so much more dangerous now to you, and you trust me because I'm coming from a very well-educated firsthand glance as opposed to just telling you something you can find online on your own. That is the secret sauce to this whole game. You have to know these clients inside and out.
Okay, let's double click on that. Before we do, I just wanted to mention a couple of the scripts that you shared that a lot of recruiters say, which I think are really ineffective. One being, you're perfect for this job, right? And you don't know the person, you've not even interviewed them yet. Like, what? How can you say that someone's perfect for a job and this is the first time you're talking to them, right? That's, as you said, an assumption, and it just doesn't ring true. It doesn't resonate. It. And then if you're the very first thing out of your mouth when you're speaking to a candidate is something which they know it can't be true because you don't know what you're talking about, then that sets a tone for the whole rest of the conversation and relationship, right? You're starting out by saying something which is factually untrue, right? That's not a good starting point. And then the flip side is talking about an amazing opportunity. I think, again, now that may be true, but that is such a platitude, and it's, you know, everybody has an amazing opportunity. It just doesn't have that ring of truth to it because everything's an amazing opportunity according to, you know, most recruiters. So I love that you've just highlighted that fact. But tell me, how do you really get inside and get embedded with these companies so that you really do know them inside out, like your favorite restaurant? You know what the best seats are. You've been there multiple times. You know what to order off the menu. How do you create that relationship with those companies?
I get in the room. I don't rely on Zoom. One of the biggest separators that I've done is I've always gone out and seen these companies, right? Because I'm a really big believer, especially when it comes to culture. It's a loose word. It's very easy to define. It's very hard to explain. So what I mean by that is when I walk into an office, there's a lot of times I even specifically like to walk in. I like to be there first thing in the morning, maybe like an 8:30, and I like to go after lunch, especially now that people are back in the office. I deal a lot in sales, so I like to see what a sales environment looks like. What I'm ultimately looking for, is there a buzz? Is there an energy? Can I feel it, right? I'm really big on senses. So when I walk into this office, what do I see, hear, feel, touch, and taste? Because then the more that I know it, I can then explain it in, again, a very dangerous way to a candidate. I can close my eyes right now, Mark. You name 100 companies. I can walk you through the entire layout. I can describe the conference room. I can tell you exactly, even from a personal standpoint, the leadership that you're going to meet, their personalities. I can imagine in my mind their offices, the pictures of their kids, the fact that he has a baseball glove, the college that he went to. Do you see how much more dangerous I become when I know that? So when I'm prepping somebody, I'm not just prepping them on, hey, they're going to ask these five questions. I'm letting these people know and painting a picture of exactly what they're walking into. That has always been a massive separator for me. Now, what do you do? I'm in Arizona. So what do you do when somebody's in Dallas, Chicago, New York, Atlanta, whatever? I find reasons. Yeah, look, I find reasons to get out there. I'm coming from the business owner lens, but that is ROI to me. That is ROI to me. And if I know I'm going to go to a city, why would I not, from a business development standpoint, be able to set up 3, 4, 5 meetings? You can give me 24 hours, I'll accomplish what I need. I've done day trips and I've maximized day trips, but the relationship is truly built in those moments because they know that I'm taking this serious as well. Because here's the biggest thing, especially from a recruiting owner lens, you have to ask yourself this question. Are you a partner or are you a vendor? There is a massive difference in the two. I never wanted to be a vendor. I never just wanted to send over an agreement. Hey, I'll send people if I have them. Let's just see how this shakes out. What I wanted to do was become a partner. I wanted to be an extension of your company. I want to be so dangerous that I'm able to speak at the highest level to the highest talent on the marketplace and bring that to you and do something no one else is doing. That's how I built this business to this day.
I love that, Brent, and I agree 100%. You know, vendors are not respected, and it's inevitably going to be more transactional and ultimately unsatisfying. Like, that's just not a fun way to recruit, right? And whereas if you're a partner, that suggests that it's a collaborative relationship. There's commitment there on both sides. They're listening to your advice. You're actually consulting with them rather than just flinging resumes at them. It's a world of difference.
Yeah, and I was going to say, look, I think that the power in relationships, I think a lot of people underestimate this. The importance behind having these deep relationships in place is for when you have to have hard conversations. See, everything's easy when things are rocking and rolling and just hiring's at a premium and just things are at a very fast pace. But there's going to be times when you have to have hard conversations too. There's going to be times. So the deeper you're entrenched with these people, the easier that becomes. See, if you're a vendor, you have no leg to stand on. You've never built that rapport with these individuals to withstand those. And that's how you compound and build these relationships that can last hard economic times, that can last over years, that last. So even when that person leaves, you all of a sudden become their person that maybe they bring with you. It's really, really important to pour into these relationships because at some point, you're going to need to pull out of it.
Absolutely. That's a good analogy as well. Tell me, I mean, I can't imagine there's anyone listening who would prefer a transactional vendor relationship over a consultative partner relationship where you have that deeper relationship. But how do you get there? That's, I guess, the biggest question, right, is most recruiters want that. How have you been able to create that? Now, you've given us a clue by saying, like, get off Zoom and get in person with people, no matter, even if you have to jump on a plane and fly across the country, then that's going to deliver an ROI if you're smart about how you do that. But what else goes into becoming a partner?
Look, here's the reality. You know what the best testimonial is? It's called results. You know, we can sit here and huff and puff and tell you how great we are and create this facade on LinkedIn, but results and numbers never lie. So one of the things that I've always done is if you've done this long enough, you kind of know the real partners you have, the candidates you've really hooked up, the relationships that you're really entrenched with. So I've almost created a sounding board for myself. I've almost created a fan club, if you will. And when it's needed, if a company is questioning, hey, we just want to kind of do a little due diligence, great. Who do you want to hear from? I have candidates that will tell you how amazing I am, and I have companies that will tell you exactly the same. Here's 3 or 4 names, have at it, right? So if you've built those relationships, again, to be so strong, you're going to have other people and the market tell you how great you are rather than just huff and puff or some likes and comments on LinkedIn as an example, right? The streets talk. The streets talk. So make sure that you're performing at such a high level that what they're saying is at a really high level and a good thing.
Totally, 100%. And let's circle back to talk about results. But that's so powerful to have real people who you're
prospects can call for a reference. We actually do that all the time in our coaching business as well, is if someone like they like what you've said, but they want to verify it. They want to check you out. And because maybe they've been burnt before, or, you know, it's easy to talk a good game, but what is the real service like? And so it is so valuable to be able to put them in touch with other people like them in the same position, or, you know, other recruiting firm owners in my case, and let them interview that person about what we do. So I love that. Is there anything else that goes into these? I mean, obviously there's time as a factor. You've been in this industry a long time, but let's assume, like, take me back in time to when you were first getting established. You didn't have those long established relationships, right? Then how does Brent Orsuga become a partner when you don't have the same track record?
Because, well, you know, my story is pretty funny. I mean, like most people, I started out of a bedroom with nothing. And when I say nothing, I mean nothing. No agreements, no website, no email, no contracts, no candidates, literally nothing but a one-year-old child and a big vision and a chip on the shoulder, which we can get into in a second. But, you know, early on, I was so confident. And I had so many reasons to win personally that I made it so hard for these companies to tell me no. Because what I would say is, look, I know this industry. I speak this language. I know people that you don't know. There is nobody that is going to work on this stuff harder than myself. I have to win. You're a winning team. That is a dangerous combination. Give me a chance. That's all I ever wanted, especially in a contingent model. Just give me a chance. But there's very rare, it was especially early on and to this day, people would say, wow, I don't like this guy, I don't trust him, whatever. Then here's the reality, you have to perform. Once you perform, everything else is taken care of because I've backed up the talk that I've said. So it's really important just to kind of fight a little bit too. You got to fight to get in these doors. You have to fight to get in these clients. And look, going back early, Mark, I had to pay my dues. You don't just magically walk into these billion-dollar organizations, right? It's almost like an elevator. You have to start on floor one, master that, go to floor two, three, four, right? So I've paid my dues, and early on, I just wanted to perform at such a high level that I had, and confidence as well. I was using them as much as they were using me to build confidence, build momentum. Because if you can play stuff at that level, the big boy logos become even easier.
Can you elaborate on this? I like this analogy of the elevator and like paying your dues. What exactly do you mean by that? And what does that mean? What does that look like in practical terms?
Yes. So especially early on, like I didn't have the background. I didn't have the results to be able to go huff and puff and tell these amazing, you know, top 100 companies in my industry how great I was. I wasn't there yet. So what I had to do was get what I'm going to call repetitions, right? I had to get confidence. I had to understand the process. I had to work with some of these, let's call it C or B type companies. But I also knew if I could perform and put people in those organizations, everything else was going to be easier. So selfishly, I was doing that to enhance my own skills. That is where the confidence comes from. Confidence comes from competence. Confidence comes from competence. So the more that I was able to get results at that level, all it was doing was creating an internal belief as well that, man, you can do this. You belong here. You can do this. You're really good at this. The results speak for themselves. And then it just compounded and compounded. So once you get that confidence, and going back to being a basketball player, once I knew I could hit those threes, well, now everything else opens up for me and I can go chase these bigger logos, and or they're going to know enough about me. They're all of a sudden going to come to me and I'm going to attract them.
Love it. This is awesome. So let's talk about the early days of Pinnacle Growth Advisors then, because you sort of painted a picture. You're in your spare bedroom. You have a one-year-old child and a chip on your shoulder. So let's start there. Why did you start Pinnacle Growth Advisors? And then, you know, what was it like in the early days?
Well, I started it out of what I'm going to call a necessity, all right? Inspiration by desperation. So what I was doing was I was running with someone, a partner for, call it 5 years, May 1st, 2014, my email shut off. 5 minutes later, I get a letter that we're done. No red flags, no heads up, done, okay? So within 48 hours, you hit this crossroads of life. I was 37 at the time. I hit that crossroad of life. either I'm going to go this way and I can go be an employee, I know I can always get a job, or I'm going to go this way and bet on myself. Now, someone like me, the way that I'm wired, like I said, I had a chip on my shoulder. I had reasons to win. I had a one-year-old child. I had a wife. I said, let me go. I believe enough in myself. I'm going to do this. Now, little did I know how challenging this would be. But again, I just went into massive action. I didn't have a website. I didn't even have an email. I had no bankroll in the back pocket. But I had a belief, I had a vision, and again, I had a desire to win that there was nothing, and I mean nothing, that was going to get in my way, right? And it worked. Early on, just give me a chance, give me a chance, give me a chance. That's all I was asking for, and people would, because they believed in me and they believed in my desire. And then the results spoke for themselves.
Hey, Brent, there's so much here I want to ask you about. But so for a lot of people, when they start a business, there's a lot of planning that goes into this, right? They're maybe thinking about it for years, and they're maybe saving up, you know, so they have a buffer, you know, in the bank account, so they pay their living expenses for 6 months or whatever, or they've taken a bank loan, or they've written a business plan. You were like thrown into this situation. You had to decide fast, like, am I going to get a job, or what am I going to do? So you didn't have the benefit of all that planning, or necessarily the, you know, the savings and recruiting. There's always a lag time, right? So like, even if day one you start cold calling, you get a job, and then you have to fulfill it. So the interview process takes however many weeks, and then you know, they have 2 weeks notice, then you invoice, then it takes, you know, 2, 4, 6 weeks or more to get paid. How did you survive in those early days when you just like had to make this work?
Yeah, look, what you don't see behind, or what you can't see behind me, is right here is my very first check ever. It took 90 days and it was for $7,500, and it felt like $75,000, right? So I'll never forget that. Look, I had enough of a cushion. I had a wife that was still working, so it gave me a little breathing room. But I'll be honest, I always came from the mindset, I never want to ask anybody for anything. I never want to ask a family member for a penny. I don't want to ask my wife for a dime, because I wanted her to know three words. I got it. I got it. That's all you need to know. And she looks at me, and you got to look at me and not believe in me, right? Just, I got it. Just let me do my thing. So I work differently too. See, when your back is to the wall and there is no plan B, you have no option. There is a no option mentality to me. I still live this way to this day. There is no plan B. There is no alternative. I have got to win. And I still, 10 years later, even with all the accolades and awards, that is the mindset I take to this day. In a contingent model, guess what? You start at zero every single month. Some people say, well, why don't you do retainer? Why don't you do that? And I can't answer that outside of it's how I'm built. It's how I'm wired, and it keeps me cranking and performing at a high level, because I have no option. I have no alternative to win. Therefore, the candidates and the companies love it, because they know how I show up every single day. I am all gas, no brakes, Mark.
Okay, awesome. Why do you have a chip on your shoulder though, Brent? Where does that come from?
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, that's sports too, right? So I've always learned playing basketball. I was always able to create what I'm going to call these mental games for myself. The reality was, it was never about the opponent, but I could hone out an opponent, a player, a fan in the crowd, and I would create these mental games with myself to be like, okay, I think they said something. They looked at me funny. Now let's go compete. So it was actually really never about that person, but that was a skill that I learned at an early age. When I had to go through that experience in 2014, see, I never forget that moment and how hard that was at that time. So that person that did that all of a sudden became enemy number one, right? So I'm going to show you, I'm going to prove a point. I'm going to show you that you made a mistake. This was going to be the biggest error that you made. And now I'm going to do it at such a high level. I'm going to make you watch me. I'm not even going to block you. I'm going to make you watch my success. And every day, when I didn't feel like it, when I was unmotivated, I leaned on that and I played these mental games with myself to make sure that I went into action. So I still do that to this day. It's not even about a competitor. It's not even about anything else, but I create these triggers for myself to work hard and lock in when I need.
Wow. Okay. That's, That's not the answer I was expecting. I've not heard anyone say something quite like that before, Brent. It's almost like you've manufactured that chip. It didn't come from, you're creating it for yourself to get yourself in the state of mind where you're competing.
Yeah, this may sound or come across the wrong way, but I play angry. And so in order to play angry, I have to find triggers for myself. So I'll even go through a LinkedIn feed. And again, has nothing to do with that person. I'm using them as fuel. They've never done anything to me. They've never burned me, but I'm creating these triggers in my mind. Oh, that person's got a bigger business. This person's talking about a placement. Okay, let me go get two. It's the competitive wiring that I have that I've never been able to turn off, even at 47. So I'm utilizing things and that I see and hear to get myself an emotion. It works for me. That's all I can say.
Wow, that's funny. So when I got into recruiting, Brent, I actually did have a chip on my shoulder, and it was, I mean, I think all of us can find something. If you're wired a certain way, you can find something that you feel like you have to prove, you've got something to prove, right? And for me, it was my first, I started a business when I was in university. It was like a painting franchise. You probably have heard of College Pro Painters. It was similar to that. And I lost my shirt. Like I worked 60, 70, 80 hours a week. And I made less than minimum wage. I ended up owing like tens of thousands of dollars. And so there was that. And then also I moved to a new country and I felt like I had to be successful. Like I had to make money to prove I wasn't a total loser. Number one, number two, like I almost felt like to my friends and family back home, like I had to make something of myself and I couldn't ever go home as a failure, if that makes sense. I had to like make this work to show that my decision-making, like there was, you know, that it was the right thing to do. I don't know if you can relate to that or if that makes sense at all.
Oh, of course. I mean, not just that, but I've always made sure that I have what I call reasons to win. That's still one of the biggest interview questions that I ask candidates to this day. Hey, where are you at chapter of life? See, now being 47, married, two kids, I had a dad that passed in 2016, became the man of my family overnight. Mark, those are reasons to win. I don't have an option. My back is to the wall every day, but to perform and win at a high level. So again, this is just the mindset that I come in. The minute I walk into this office, usually around 7 a.m., I am not here to play games. I'm not here to mess around. I'm not here to scroll on social media. This has become the new arena to me. That's all this is. You get me in here, I am locked in. This is a performance center. There is an expectation to win. If you don't see it, but there's two very big signs on my wall. One says, if you don't kill it, your family won't eat. That is a mindset. You have to be a hunter, Brent, not a farmer. Perform. The other one says, and I hate to say this, but no one cares, work harder. What that means is the minute that I walk in this door, I leave all the outside noise outside. I don't bring it in here. So if I'm having stuff going on with family, if I'm having stuff going on with friends, if I'm having other outside variables, I compartmentalize them. So again, this office becomes a performance center. Now, the other thing that I've been able to do is I've been able to use Pinnacle as kind of a platform for what I'm going to call pain. So losing a father, I show up the next day, this becomes my release. If something is going on in my outside world, I'm channeling that energy and using it here properly. So when you hear me talking about playing in a very high level mindset, playing angry, I'm channeling everything and putting it out into my work. This is my release.
Wow. Interesting. Interesting how you're turning everything to fuel. Let's talk about morning routines because you mentioned you show up in the office at 7 a.m. And I believe I read a book called The 5 a.m. Club, but it sounds like you get up even earlier than that. Can you talk us through your morning routine?
Yeah, I actually did a day in the life video because I think a lot of people didn't believe me, but this was real. So at that time, set alarm for 3:30. Honestly, my human alarm clock is usually there. What I'll do is we go to Lifetime Gym out here. It opens at 4 o'clock. So at 4 o'clock, knowing that my buddy is going to show up, my lifting buddy, around 4:45, that gives me 45 minutes of alone time. Now, the other thing I'm doing before that is I'm a really big into personal development. There is a 13-minute clip by Les Brown that I listen to every single morning. And what I'm doing is I'm getting my mindset into a very positive, motivated state intentionally. This is not random. When I get to Lifetime, what are the things I do? One of two things. Either I'm going to ride a bike, and when I'm riding the bike, I'm doing either listening to a podcast, one like yours, or I'm shooting hoops by myself. I'm talking to myself some days. I'm planting the seeds of what do I want to accomplish today? Where am I at, right? So that gives me that alone time. Then my buddy shows up. We lift. I come home at 6 o'clock. I play dad. I got two little girls. So all of a sudden, I'm doing the breakfast routine, getting them ready for school, get them off their way, and then I'm coming into the office. Again, once I'm here at 7, you got to remember, I'm on the West Coast. So by that time, it's 10 o'clock in Atlanta, 10 o'clock in New York, 9 o'clock in Chicago. Things are rocking and rolling. But the minute I walk in here, this is something I think a lot of people can find value in as well. I'm going to do what I call offense, not defense. I'm playing offense. What I mean by that is I am going to dictate the day. See, it would be very easy to walk in here at 7 a.m. and go into my email, right? I'm just playing defense at that point because I'm letting the day dictate me all of a sudden. But before I start to get into that sector, if I look at my board, okay, what companies do I have to contact? What candidates? What loose ends aren't tied up? Who's expecting an offer today? And then I go into action, sending texts, sending emails. Again, I'm pushing out what I want to control. After I do that, then I'll step into the world. Then I can contact the team. Then I can kind of get into emails. And then we're going into action. But again, a lot of what I do in the morning is very intentional. It's very directed, and I'm calling the shots.
Love it. And I love Les Brown, by the way. Afterwards, would you send me the clip that you listened to?
It's amazing. Yeah. If you don't mind running through a brick wall early in the morning, I will send it to you.
All right. Yeah. He's such a good speaker, man. And like his whole story as well is inspiring too. So, your day starts at 7. Can you give us a few more highlights of like how you structure your day?
Yeah. So I'm very intentional. I do a lot of what I'm going to call work in time blocks as well, because I don't want to be distracted. So for me, I live on my calendar. Like most days, there's going to be a lot of both client calls as well as candidate calls. But if there's ever breaks, what I'm going to do is that's even me being a player coach. I'm still in the weeds. I set that time aside for maybe it's sourcing, maybe it's going on LinkedIn and building out the network. There's never a down moment in my world. I'm very much maximizing my time, but I carve it out on my calendar. So when it pops up, it's not by mistake. See, I may even do that at 7 in the morning. If I will log on and I see a 30-minute block, well, I'm not going to leave that as 30 minutes. I'm going to intentionally put something in there because, again, ultimately what I'm trying to do is create the playbook, going back to sports. I want every day to have a playbook. That way, Mark, I don't have to think. All I have to do is execute. I don't play loose.
Okay, a couple of things. So first of all, as far as I know, all or at least the majority of high performers in business use time blocking to maximize their productivity. So you're not randomly floating around. You're working in concentrated blocks of time. It's all intentional. It's all planned out. The second thing that you mentioned is, it's just gone because you reminded me of something, but in any case, don't worry. So you've got your blocks of time and what are the activities that you're focused on?
Yeah. So who writes us the checks? The companies, right? In reality, those are the bread and butter. So a lot of times what I'm doing is I'm having very strategic calls with these companies. Hey, what are we looking for? Where do we stand with these candidates? Where are we missing, right? I want to make sure that we're getting this right. I don't want to crawl inside your head on a lot of things. A mind reader is not one of them. So I want to make sure that every search that we're working on is very strategic. Then I want to take that information and be able to convey it down the line to whatever recruiters we have. Hey, this is exactly what they're looking for. There should be no looseness. Then also, as I'm doing my own sourcing, everything I'm doing is now very methodical, very strategic, and I still have a lot of calls throughout the day. Look, from a recruiting standpoint, there's no better day than a full calendar. We love to talk, right? I would love it if I could just walk in and have a full day of candidate and client calls. If that's not going to be there, I'm going to try to organically create that for myself as well, because I want to be on the phone as much as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you track like phone time, and do you know how long you're on the phone on a typical day or?
No, because results never lie. I know presentations, right? Like, I mean, there's really only one thing. Like when I was back at the MRI days, that was something that it was me and this guy, Spencer, I'll never forget. They used to track our talk time, and every day at lunch, they would post it in the board, and it was me and him neck and neck. From a competitive standpoint, you give me someone like that, I'm not coming in number two. But, you know, nowadays the game has changed a little bit. While I'm still very much proactive on a cold calling standpoint, we live in a different world. So I don't focus so much on call volume or talk time. I focus on high level presentations. That tells me everything I need to know. It's a very easy formula. It's outputs and inputs. Don't overcomplicate this thing.
So what are the outputs and inputs that you care most about?
I think recruiting is a high contact sport. I think people grossly underestimate how many people they have to engage with to get people in process. I tell everybody, at any given time, you probably want to have as close to 10 people in process as possible. Because there's no recruiter in this world, as good as we all are, that's going to go 10 for 10. We're dealing with human variables, right? But what I'm also looking for is trying to understand your metrics and your data. So for every 10 people, if we're getting 4 placements, okay, now I kind of have some formulas and understand your profiles. This should also be a formula that you can work off of. So if you want to get 2 placements a month, well, I know it's going to probably lead to this many presentations, this many interviews. See, you can really turn everything into a math equation if you think about it.
Yeah, for sure. So could you explain what you mean by 10 people in process?
Yeah, interviewing, actively interviewing. So now that could be a phase one, it could be a final stage and everything in between. But here's why I think that's important. When people have 1 or 2 people in process, that is where emotions get involved because you need those deals. So it's very easy to go from 2 people to 0 in 24 hours. All of a sudden, that is a demoralizing feeling right now. Oh my goodness, I can't believe it. Now I'm starting back over at 0. If I have 10 people in process and I lose 2, I don't feel it as much. That's why I convey people to have that.
Okay, got it. So that's 10 people, but they're not necessarily going to 10 different jobs, right? You might have multiple people interviewing for the same position.
100%. Now, I try not to have all my eggs in one basket, but again, that goes back to the talent advising mindset. I just want to find the best talent possible. The reality is I can probably find them a home. So we're going to have 2 sides of the coin from the business. We're going to have very strategic headhunting. Brent, we need this in this city. That is strategic. But we're also going to have what I'm going to call open-ended relationships where, man, Brent, we know you deal with the best people out there. You come across a hitter and you know is a good fit for us. Don't hesitate to show. Great. Got it. Will do. I play in both sides.
Okay. I like it. Could you talk a little about your team and what support system you have in place there?
Yeah. So I've always, you know, look, no matter what, even 10 years later, I've always been a player coach. I've always still been in the weeds. Part of it because I still love what I do. I look at myself as the Jerry Maguire of freight. I love working deals. I want to be a sports agent. It doesn't get old to me, right? Because we're changing lives in reality. That's what you're doing. You're changing people's trajectories. A lot of the business development still runs through my fingers. So I'm still going to be able to kind of have those client conversations, bring the opportunities to the table. And then we have a team of recruiters behind us that do a lot of the sourcing, right? So I'm able to convey exactly what these people need and convey it down to them. I think no matter what, though, even when you are leading a team, I think the biggest thing you got to implement is you got to lead from the front. You got to set the tone and the standard for who you are, what works, how we operate, and that's how you build a high-performing, even internal team.
So how many recruiters have you got supporting you?
5 all across the country. So we got a couple in Florida, Ohio, Illinois, kind of spread out as far as that goes. And then obviously I'm here in Scottsdale.
All right, cool. Could you tell the story of the Inc. 5000 and what that meant to you and how you accomplished it?
Yeah, so I think it's a very inspiring yet realistic story. So as anyone who's going to apply for the Inc. 5000, here's a little tidbit. So it's going to be based on a 3-year track record, right? So let's just call it 2021, 22, and 23. Not only do you have to break the 2 million threshold, that's kind of their bare minimum, but they're going to rank you off of that 3-year run. So back in 2019, I said, I'm going to do this. I became obsessed with it. And what I did is I had a graphic made from the future. And what it said was 2023 winner. This is no joke. 2023 winner. What I did with that graphic is I put it everywhere. I put it on my TV in front of me. It was my phone screen saver. I talked about it. I put it all around me. And what I did is I created an internal belief. This was not a, hey, this would be nice to have. This was me putting this out into the universe. This is going to happen. I had group text chains written around Inc. 5000 winner. I started to identify myself as that. And so it's crazy because it became so real to me that last June when I got the email, I had played that movie out in such in my mind so many times. It had already happened that I didn't actually get as emotional as I thought because I expected it to happen. And I created that belief around me.
And was it actually the exact year that you projected?
100%, because we won it on 2020, which think about that. In 2020, we actually lost everything come March, right? Nobody needed headhunters March 2020. So it actually made the story that much better. But 2021 and 22, absolutely. So it was an amazing feat, but I don't think it happened by accident because here's why. I was vocal about my goals. And what I did, the more that I talked about it, I didn't get doubters. I didn't get haters. I got people to rally and believe me. So now all of a sudden I created, going back to kind of that fan club mentality, people were rooting for me to win. Clients were rooting for me. Candidates were rooting for me. It's like no different than somebody saying, man, I'm going to do whatever it takes to win a Super Bowl ring, whatever it takes. People are going to want to see that happen. So I think it was an inspiration for people as well when it became a reality.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Like when you have certainty about what you want and why it's important and what your purpose is, then that's a very attractive quality. People really like when you're projecting that energy, then it rallies people to your cause to support you and, you know, help you make that happen, right? It's like a magnet.
Yeah, and think about this. How do we get results? We help other people. So all it was for me to get that award, I had to help as many people as possible. Who wouldn't rally behind that, right? I'm not selling insurance. I'm not selling mortgages. I'm not building homes. I'm changing lives. I'm getting people into a better career situation. I'm helping companies scale. So any of these awards and accolades all have a really significant meaning because in recruiting, we actually win last. The company has to win, the candidate has to win, and recruiters win last. Why would you not want to see us win? Everyone's going to win in front of us. So it's a good thing as far as that goes. Start winning awards. I tell everyone that. Start winning awards. Start aiming for these things because it means that you're servicing the industry that you play in at a high level. That's all it is.
Yeah. So the criteria then, you need to be above $2 million in revenue. What else do you need to do to qualify?
They're going to base it on a 3-year growth trajectory. So you're going to have to turn in tax returns. Like for me, I turned in a tax return from 2020. I turned in a tax return from 2022. And then they would rank you based on that growth that you experienced. I think in our place, it was, we more than doubled every year. So I think we got ranking 34, 23 out of the 5,000. So I'll take it. Mark, I didn't care if I was 4999. You get me in that room.
So it's based on growth. Is that like how the compound annual growth rate or
revenue? It was all based on revenue growth. Correct.
And in order to even get on the 5,000th, then like what sort of percentage growth do you think is the minimum that you'd need?
Well, based on like the people that I saw like in the 4,800s, it was still probably a 70% kind of growth. During that run rate. So it was still pretty significant as far as that goes. But it's pretty crazy because the people in the top 10 are like 34,000%, a lot of tech type companies and stuff like that. But look, everyone was so cool in the room. And that's what I just found a lot of value in it because we're in a service-based industry, right? Service. They always say service-based companies are actually the hardest to scale.
Yes, for sure. And especially something like headhunting where it's not like you can increase manufacturing of widgets, right? You're having to train and coach other people to do something that's actually pretty hard, right? It's not easy. And to get like to grow beyond yourself, like there's a I don't want to say there's a limit because you can always increase your production, right? But when you get to a certain level, you're not going to double your production like every year without then hiring, training, coaching other people. That's how you would increase your revenue. And it's a hard thing to teach. So I'm impressed. Tell me, why supply chain and logistics? Why are you passionate about that industry?
Yeah. So, I mean, it really started. So if going back to MRI, when I started in construction, it was a very easy industry for me to play in because I hate to say this, but it was kind of a guy's guy, blue collar. It allowed me to be myself, right? I could just be very fluid in how I speak. I had a really easy connection and correlation with these people. So in 2009, because construction went away in 2008, like many industries. So in 2009, when I teamed up with that individual, they were actually in supply chain. I didn't know anything about it, but what I realized very similarly were construction and supply chain trucking were pretty similar, at least from the profile standpoint. So now here I am 15 years later, but you know, one of the things that we talked about, supply chain is an industry. Mark, it cannot go away. Everything comes on a truck. You look behind you. That microphone came on a truck, that plant, that table, that desk that you're sitting at, your glasses, everything has come on a truck. There is a crazy video on YouTube called 5 Days Without a Truck. The world stops. The world stops. Look at during COVID. Supply chain was the buzzword. Nobody talked about boats in the water at these ports, right? Nobody talked about it. And it became the hottest thing out there. So now I am passionate about it. And one of the things we spoke about, I think no matter what industry you're in, the trucking industry is the backbone of the country. It is one of the most telling signs of economic good or bad. When things are rocking and rolling, there's boats, there's containers, right? Things need to come in. There's trucks everywhere. You're going to see Amazon trucks and UPS all over. You want to see trucks on the road. It means the economy is healthy, which impacts every industry.
Absolutely. And so what are you seeing in terms of the, you know, the market? And because I guess I never thought of it that way, but logistics is an indicator then of the health of the economy. So what are you seeing in the logistics industry? And then what's your interpretation of what that means to the wider economy?
Yeah, I mean, to be super transparent, the trucking industry has really been hurt pretty hard since October of 22. I mean, we obviously, the industry went through massive layoffs like many people last year because the economy has gotten harder, right? You've had inflation, you've had costs go up, you've had all these things which impact what I'm going to call consumer spending. Because when money is tight, people have to then make decisions, right? A lot of product is extra money, right? They have extra money. So maybe they're going on Amazon and all of a sudden spending things different. But when you have to make a decision between bills and extra, when you have to make a decision between extra or vacation, that is going to impact product, which impacts the movement of goods. So that is kind of where we are seeing things. And think about all the people that have been laid off. All of a sudden, they don't have extra to go buy things, right? And so you're seeing a lot of that happen too.
Yeah, it's so weird. Like the economy is so weird right now because like I just read an article last week that the growth in the US economy has exceeded projections. And so measured, like it depends how you measure this, right? And what you're looking at. Because if you measure like GMP, then the US economy is growing. But then in certain sectors, you've got these mass layoffs. And then from a consumer point of view, because of inflation, it feels harder, like your money isn't going as far. So it's weird. Like what from the point of view of how it's impacting your individual business, like, you know, how are you feeling about the market?
Well, in my world, it's very easy to kind of know where we are because it boils down to one of two things. It's either sales or it's operations. So I call it offense and defense. Sales is offense, right? So right now we're in a very, what I'm going to call revenue driving phase. Because here's the reality. You have to have sales. Sales drives every other position. I don't need customer success. I don't need accounting. I don't need extra operational support people if we don't have the business. And when on the flip side of that, like during that whole COVID run, everything was operations because it was almost like there was an abundance of freight. You had to service it. You didn't have to sell it. So what I look for as a very big telling sign is my world, when am I starting to get those operational calls? Because that means things are healthy. That means that all of a sudden we have too much where we don't have the bandwidth internally. So right now it's a little more sales heavy than I like, because that means that we're still fighting a little bit, if you will.
Okay. That's a good way of describing it. So apart from the things we've already discussed, Brent, like what are there any other success factors that you feel have contributed meaningfully to you being able to build a firm that's over 2 million and fast growing?
Yeah, look, I think that I've always been a big believer. Maybe this is a Les Brown thing. Riches are in the niches. I play one sport. This is all I do. So the minute that I'm either talking to a company or the minute that I'm talking to a candidate, they know that this is what I do. This is the language I speak. This is the sport that I play. I'm dangerous here. I'm the person. I have the relationships. I have the contacts. See, a lot of people, and there's no right or wrong to this. I know people that have built firms or divisions around construction and accounting and healthcare and all these various things. And I think that if you're going to do that, you almost have to find a subject matter expert who speaks that language to run that for you. But if you're going to be a player coach like myself, I'm not spread thin, Mark. I know exactly where I play. I think that's been one of the biggest secrets is I have not veered from that nor had to yet.
Awesome. Yeah, 100%. We believe in that. And everything we teach is predicated on really focusing on a niche. And, you know, it means that there's no wasted conversation. Every conversation you have with a client or a candidate, you can use, you know, even if you can't place that person, you're going to learn something. You're going to get more information about your market. You're going to get a referral or what have you, right? We're on the same page there. Anything else you think has been part of the, you know, Brent Orsuga success story?
I expect to win. Every day when I walk in this office, I'm not surprised when things come in my favor. So it's a mentality shift. I think a lot of times people, they self-sabotage themselves. Where for me, because I know that if I put in the work that I'm going to do every day, if I show up here every day, if I'm time blocking, if I'm controlling the controllables and doing everything I'm supposed to do, my expectation for things to work the way they should for the universe to reward me is at a premium. And I think that aligns accordingly. I'm actually more surprised when things don't go my way. So I think even having that mindset shift is essential. You got to assume the universe and people and things want to see you win. And if you put in the work, it usually should correspond.
I mean, this is such a mental game for sure, recruiting. And like, you literally are creating your own success out of nothing. Like, it's one of those, like we said earlier, it's not like manufacturing where you've got a product and you've got an assembly line. Like, we're making things happen that, you know, it left to their own devices, these candidates and these clients. I mean, there's a chance some of them might still have found each other, but there's an even greater chance that that deal would have never happened without your intervention, right? You are literally, you know, it's like alchemy. You're creating wealth and you're creating opportunities. You're making deals happen kind of out of thin air that wouldn't have happened otherwise. So the mindset part is so important. But when you say you expect to win, how are you physically creating that expectation? I mean, you've given a clue, like you're structuring your time, you're listening to either podcasts or Les Brown, like motivational stuff. But is there anything else that's helping you to create that certainty inside yourself?
Yeah, I mean, even myself, I'm always surrounding myself. Like, what you don't see in front of me is some post-it notes that I've had, and I interchange these, right? It just said, I'll even share, I have nothing to hide. I'll tell you what they say. Focus, lock in. You are the best. Suze, my wife, and the kids need you to win. Stay on top. People are coming. Stop playing small. No one's coming to save you. 10 years in, no mistakes. This is around, like, this may sound foo-foo, whatever. This is around me at all times. So anytime that I think I'm distraction, I look down. And these are these triggers that I talk about. So I'm always creating triggers. I might have a picture of my kid. I might have a picture of a trip I'm looking to be on, an award that I want to win. You know, there's been times where I've gotten real crazy and almost created a bulletin board of people that I want to create that chip on the shoulder against, right? So again, I'm always finding ways to get myself into action, and then it leads me to be able to perform. So that just works for me.
What I like about that, Brent, is like most people, and now our listeners are not most people, right? The people listening to the show are the ones who they have that desire to succeed, and they're also like learning, they're interested in personal development, they're trying to improve, they want to grow, improve, get better results. But I suspect most people, like when they show up to work, they're just going with the flow. They haven't intentionally designed their environment or, you know, set those triggers, as you said, or designed their schedule in such a way that it's putting themselves in the right frame of mind that they're going to get the most out of themselves, right? And they're just bouncing around from one task to the next. And then if something bad happens, which, you know, that's life. Bad things are going to happen. You know, candidate's not going to accept their job. They're going to get countered or, you know, whatever. The client changes the goalpost. Then that has a, like, that just throws them way off course, right? Because they haven't put those, you know, triggers, as you call them, in place that are going to help them to re-engage and refocus on what they can control and get back into action. Does that make sense?
Well, it does 100%. Because again, I'm still in this, right? So I still take the hits, but there's always been a couple things that I've learned. Number one, you got to be able to detach emotion. I don't get emotional, right, anymore. I used to early on, right? Something goes sideways. Oh my God, it's like a 10 out of 10. I think you really have to understand what is really a 10 out of 10, because most of the things that we deal with are about a 3. So learning how to have emotional regulation is a skill that you have got to master, number one. Number two, you know, the other thing is, if things are hard, business is hard, you have to become hard. You have to become hard physically. You have to become hard mentally in order to combat that. So I punch back. You know, one of my biggest favorite movies, Mark, is Rocky. I grew up on the Rocky movies, right, in the 80s. And there's always a scene that is very important to me. In Rocky 2, this sounds crazy, but Apollo was punching him, and he got knocked down. David Goggins has talked about this exact scene. And he looks over at him, and Rocky just gets up, and he keeps coming. That's always been my mindset.
And keep punching. And the look in Apollo's face, showing he's up. Like,
yeah,
what the hell?
He's defeated. Keep punching, keep showing up, keep coming at their throats, keep going, and things will work in your favor. This is more mental than people think. A lot of people that watch your show, people I surround, so small boutique firm owners, solopreneurs, no one's coming to save you. This is you and you. You know, one of the things I have on my desk, I posted about this yesterday, Mark, is a mirror, a little mirror, okay? You know what I do with that? I look at myself throughout the day sometimes to remind myself, hey, this is on you, buddy. This is on you. So that no plan B, that back to the wall mindset, that is what I have. Triggers around me at all given times, like I talked about. This is not joke. I'm showing you the real stuff here.
I love it. It's great to actually, although I'm not physically with you, it's great to learn what your environment is like. So listen, here's the challenge, Brent, is you've won your award, your Inc. 5000 that you were dreaming of. You've exceeded 2 million. How do you now stay motivated to take it even further, right? Because I'm guessing that you're reasonably comfortable where you are, and being comfortable can be a bad thing, right? So what's the vision? Where do you take things from here, and how do you stay motivated to achieve it?
Yeah, so I'm a chaser. You got to give me a rabbit. You got to give me a carrot and I'm going to go attack it, right? So I'm always having to organically create those for myself. So that's the thing too. The Inc. 5000, Mark, it really wasn't about the award. You know what it was? It was about how do I get to 2 million to even apply? That's all it was about. I used that as a trigger. So that's what I'm always trying to do, especially in our world. It's very revenue driven, right? Because the more revenue means more placements. Let's just call it what it is. So I'm always trying to find some award, some accolades, some metric that I can move, that all that becomes now is the vehicle. That becomes the rabbit. So that's kind of where we are now. Look, I don't get comfortable. I don't allow myself to get comfortable. If I'm feeling comfortable for a second, I'm going to get uncomfortable. Maybe I'll take something on that is over my skis so that it forces me into action. I'm not saying that's good or healthy, but I do this stuff intentionally to force myself into action again.
But this is, it's hard, right? Because the way human beings are wired is that we very quickly get used to whatever, like, even something like, if you think about it, having a hot shower, the pleasure, the privilege of having a hot shower, most people just take that for granted. They don't even appreciate it. And yet in throughout most of history, and even today in some parts of the world, that's something you don't take for granted, right? That's not something that everybody gets to enjoy. And yet we don't think anything about that. And so it's so easy to get lulled into this, like, feeling like you just get used to what you've already got. So how do you avoid getting comfortable?
Well, I'll give you a real example that happened last week. So again, going back to being part of the Entrepreneurs Organization, every year my forum, there's 8 of us business owners, we go on a yearly retreat. And last week, we went over to Cuba. The value in that was what I'm going to call perspective. I don't think any of us 8 people will ever say business is hard again, because we saw hard. We sat with the people over there and heard their challenges. You think all of a sudden me losing a counteroffer became hard? You think I could sit across from these people who told me the challenges that they have to face, that would resonate with them? So again, sometimes you got to put yourself in those kind of situations to not only have the gratitude, but also the perspective of what's hard. A lot of this stuff is mental junk, that we create internally in our heads. And if you really take a lens or a different lens in the grand scheme of things, that's what I'm saying. Not everything's a 10, right? Not all this stuff is as big and bad as people think. But look, I'm a chaser. I'm a driver. I like to win. I hate to lose. That is wiring that I cannot turn off. I just find reasons to do it over and over and over again.
Brent, this has been fun. I'm really glad that we got a chance to sit down together. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, I appreciate you having the ask, and excited to share this when it comes out.
Fantastic. All right, Brent, have an awesome day.